Before I ask them to get the slides up and go through a few brief concluding remarks, I do want to thank all of you for your attendance at this conference. Suzanne just told me that we have 1,621 people here at the conference, which is the highest attendance in a decade. Not bad for a not bad for a pandemic year and a global recession and everything else that's been going on. So I'm delighted that so many of you were able to attend and that so many of you have stuck around till the final closing session of the conference. I'd also like to thank all of the people besides you, the attendees, who helped make this conference so successful this year. That would be all of our staff volunteers who've helped with finding rooms and the staff from the Immunization Services Division who've been so involved in conference planning, especially Suzanne Johnson, who is here somewhere. Suzanne, wave, please. As well as our conference contractor and especially the AV guys over there in the corner who've handled all the technology stuff without a hitch. So thanks to everybody for helping make this such a great conference. It's really been terrific to be here and get a chance to get caught up with so many of you and hear about all the really interesting things that have gone on since we got together last. I always have an opportunity to put together a few closing remarks for the conference, and I've done different things in different years. In 2008, for the immunization conference, which I've thought a lot about because that was, of course, the last time the conference was in Atlanta, I remember how unsettled and agitated, particularly that first day of the conference, was. It was a very unsettled sort of time. Now, it had something to do with the fact that a tornado had hit Atlanta the weekend before, and downtown Atlanta streets were closed, there was broken glass everywhere. Those of us who were driving from in town, you know, really weren't sure we were gonna make it to the conference hotel that morning. But it wasn't just that. There had been recent press reports about a case that the injury compensation program was going to settle. Of a child who had mitochondrial disorders, and all of a sudden the half dozen people in the United States who actually know much about mitochondrial disorders were getting phone calls from all of us. And there were a lot of things going on that made it a kind of unsettled and uncomfortable kind of time. And it was a lot of people were pretty anxious at the beginning of that conference, is the way I remember it. This year, in contrast, I thought on the first day people just seemed tired. And it's sort of like, you know, we thought a tornado before the conference was bad. Well, this year it was a pandemic. And it was a recession. And it was layoffs in state and local health departments and not enough people. And then influenza everywhere and not enough vaccine. And just all this stuff you all have been having to deal with. And so I sort of have the sense at this meeting that, you know, the cellar door is now open and we're coming up the stairs and we're starting to look around and see what's left. And we can now go beyond the first slide. Whoops, not that far beyond. Back to number two. Can we go back to number two? Okay, this is what was supposed to come up. It's been quite a year, and so I've got the chance to provide a few thoughts about some of the things I heard in the conference, some of the things I've heard from some of you, and some of what we're all dealing with, because it's really been quite a year. This is what you just did, and I won't say we because I didn't do this. I was actually dealing with sort of the our center's work outside of H1N1. So this is you. And here's what you did. You took pandemic plans that were written for a very different pandemic, and you retool them on the fly, you know, the proverbial building a plane while you're flying it, for H1N1, a very different pandemic. And in the course of that, you recruited new immunization providers, and you took charge of allocating initially very limited vaccine. You used your immunization information systems in new ways, and for some of the systems were ready to do it, and some of them weren't. But all of them, I think, will end up being stronger for the efforts that you made this last year. You worked across sectors to make influenza vaccine available to ACIP priority groups. This involved working with education, working with obstetricians, working with those adult providers who aren't your VFC providers. They're a completely different group of people. And you all worked with them to make the immunization program happen. You solved all kinds of problems in very creative ways. And between the H1N1 monovalent vaccine and the seasonal trivalent vaccine, this year you delivered more influenza vaccines to more Americans than ever before. Just a couple of slides to make the point about what a big accomplishment this was. The next couple of slides are from Dr. Shuckert's presentation in the opening session about the number of provider agreements you all got signed during this last year to expand the number of provider groups that could deliver the H1N1 vaccine. You know, we have around 40,000 VFC providers in the United States, and this was almost 120,000. This is a slide that Anne showed in her session, and I think Jim showed it in the session that preceded this one as well, that compared to seasonal vaccines, people got vaccines in some different places, and that was because of your work. There were more people got vaccinated in hospitals, health departments, and schools than we usually see during seasonal influenza vaccination. And as a result of your work, we were able to reduce disease, death, healthcare costs, and disruption. Once vaccine became available, there were more than 325,000 vaccine shipments to more than 70,000 sites. And in the range of 70 to 80 million Americans were vaccinated, including more pregnant women and school-aged children than we usually see in an average flu season. But this is what we're now afraid of, that this is the new baseline. That now since you did it, everybody's going to think you can do it every year. And of course, you did it with some extra money that came from the public health emergency response grants. You did it with some extra help that came from other parts of your health department or your clinical practice or your office. You did it with some extra resources, and you did it with a lot of sleepless nights and long weekends. And so now people are afraid that this is the expectation going forward. But, you know, I think we can take some of this forward without maybe all the sleepless nights and the long weekends and learn how to do better. And I think there are some areas we can do better. One of those areas where we can do better is adolescent vaccination. Now, of course, it's gratifying that immunization coverage with our adolescent vaccines is increasing. These are data from the National Immunization Survey for the new adolescent vaccines among 13 to 17-year-olds. And based on these data from 2006 through 2008, we do see nice increases in use of these vaccines. But there's two points I'd like to make about this slide. First, if you compare the timeliness of these data to what Jim Singleton just showed us was produced in an ongoing basis as part of H1N1, these are not very timely. The most recent data in this slide are now 2 years old. So I actually have no idea what happened in 2009 or is happening now in 2010. And the overall magnitude is still, you know, less than half the girls in 2008 had received even one dose of HPV vaccine. So clearly we have a way to go to do, and we can do better. In fact, there were some very remarkable things that were achieved in childhood immunization this last year. This is the state map of the combined vaccine coverage estimates by state that was published in MMWR a couple of weeks ago, that's been shown at this conference a couple of times. And some of the states were able to achieve very remarkable levels of coverage with H1N1 vaccine this last year. One of those states was Rhode Island, and this is a slide that was from one of the presentations from the Rhode Island Immunization Program. Rhode Island was able to get 73% of K through 12 grade children vaccinated, 73% of those under 5, and 75% of the K through 4th graders ended up getting their second dose. And this was based on use of school clinics for the school-age children and then directing those preschool-age children to pediatric practices. It was really school-located vaccination clinics that made much of this high coverage happen in the states that were able to achieve it. And this was a lot of effort. There clearly are some challenges going forward. I think we would all like to see school-located vaccination clinics continue. It's a great opportunity. But there's issues besides the need to network with the education community, the resource issues. There's a couple of specific issues around the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, as well as these issues about reimbursement. It was one thing in a pandemic time where people were willing to say it's an emergency, this can be done under an emergency, but what do we do when it's not an emergency? What do we do when it's seasonal influenza vaccine, when it's our regularly recommended vaccines? Can we move the gears to make all this work? Well, we did it last year, and I think if we work on it together, we can figure out how to do it going forward. It was great to see our speaker from the Department of Education give out his email address to let him know what our problems were with FERPA. When I showed Ann these slides this morning, she asked if I was going to put his email address on this slide. I said no. But between the Association of Immunization Managers and the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists and us, we will be putting together those issues and engaging our colleagues at the Department of Education and really trying to come up with solutions that will carry us forward. Likewise, these reimbursement issues are real. And if we're talking about vaccine that the private sector needs to contribute to the payment for, that Medicaid needs to pay administration fees and so forth, we have to figure out how to do that. So I think it's a great opportunity, but it's not a slam dunk. There's clearly still some areas where we're going to have to do some work to make this happen and achieve the promise that I think this way to deliver vaccines presents to us. Now, one of the things that I think will eventually end up helping us is our ERA-funded project to improve reimbursement in public health department clinics. Dr. Bell presented this in one of the sessions this morning. As state health departments develop this capacity and a project really modeled on what Oregon did to begin with, hopefully that will help us address some of these issues going forward. Now, another area where we could do better is in vaccination of adults. These data are influenza vaccination coverage among adults in different age groups, 1993 to 2007. Again, note the incredibly lack of timeliness among the data. Our more recent NHIS data for 2008 showed an influenza vaccination coverage rate among healthcare personnel of 45%. Again, an area where it seems like we ought to be able to do better. One of the opportunities that comes out of H1N1 are all those providers you all identified and recruited and worked with This is information that was presented by the immunization program from New York City at this conference, where it looked like they actually were able to sign up to be immunization providers. More than half the providers who bill for Medicare, so for the providers who actually were serving the elderly, they were able to get more than half of them to be immunization providers for the H1N1 campaign. And they now have an established relationship with those providers. Jane Zucker has their number. And knowing Jane, they're now on her list of people that she can communicate with. They can get the updates, they can get the reminders, they can get the notice about when it's time to start pre-booking influenza vaccine, if there's new guidance that comes out about what to do, what we need to do this year. And of course, influenza, there's always something different we have to do this year. The New York City Immunization Program, just like many other immunization programs that did this kind of outreach to adult immunization providers, you now can communicate with them in ways that aren't real onerous or real expensive through email, blast faxes, and so forth. So there's an opportunity here that I think we can build on that hopefully will help us do something about improving adult immunization coverage. And so many of you did such a good job of managing all of this with all these new providers. This is a slide from Tennessee's presentation, and they really knew they needed the private sector to deliver vaccine. They knew that in order for Tennessee to achieve its objectives, they had to sign up private providers, and they had to really meet their needs and provide good customer service. So they did a follow-up survey, and these are some findings from that. Of the almost 600 providers who responded to their survey in February, almost all of them said that based on their experience, they would do it again if they were asked, and many of them, 62% were more likely to use the registry. 48% were more likely to offer seasonal flu vaccine the next fall, and 45% were more likely to offer other routine vaccines. And I think we have an opportunity to build on what, or you have an opportunity to build on what you did to improve immunization access for all the people in our country. Now, the whole issue about vaccinating healthcare workers is one that I have to say makes me crazy. It seems like we just have to do better at this. And so many states did make a focused effort to reach out to healthcare workers. This is another slide from Rhode Island. And through their strategy, they were able to get almost half of healthcare workers vaccinated through their healthcare service regions in Rhode Island, and more than two-thirds of the EMT first responders who were vaccinated through the points of dispensing. And I'm sure there were additional workers in both categories who got vaccinated in other ways as the campaign went on. Overall, though, our coverage with H1N1 vaccine for the campaign continued to be less than what it seems like we should be able to achieve. Jim Singleton just presented numbers in the session that preceded this, that coverage was less than 40% for healthcare workers. And again, it just seems like we ought to be able to do better than that. I was very excited to see a presentation that Chuck Helms gave from Iowa of a project that's been going on in Iowa for several years now, not H1N1 related, this is sort of seasonal flu vaccine, where the hospitals in Iowa are participating in a quality improvement project in which they reported voluntarily influenza vaccine coverage rates among their employees for 2 years, and they sort of worked out the kinks in terms of how to do that. And then in the third year, those coverage levels have been made public, which they weren't actually in the first 2 years. So here's the overall data for the first 3 years, and they're actually now in the fourth year of this project, but the year four data haven't been released yet. Iowa has been doing better than the rest of the country in terms of vaccination of healthcare workers. It appears with in season one, their average coverage among the healthcare institutions was 68%. In season two, it was up to 76%, and by season three, up to 79%. This is an approach that I think is very exciting. If as a country, mandates is not quite where we're ready to go, at least we can track coverage, because it seems to me that this is something that, as consumers of healthcare, people have every right to know. Are they going to an institution for that total hip replacement in the middle of winter in an institution in which a high proportion of healthcare workers are vaccinated or not? And so this is something that I think is something that could be done pretty quickly, and something that's likely to be acceptable even in a context in which mandates have often precipitated lawsuits and other actions that have made it difficult to implement them. So this is something where I think we can maybe make some progress, and we're actively working on this now. Now, this is a graphic that we haven't seen that much during this conference. This is our National Immunization Survey data. Because we've sort of been talking about other things, I think, during a lot of this meeting. But again, we've got systems where we monitor coverage that lag a lot. And these are children who were 19 to 35 months of age in 2008, so it reflects immunization practices actually from a couple years before that. But still, coverage is high, and that's good. We're glad. But a huge emphasis at this meeting on vaccine hesitancy, on the vaccine acceptance issues, on how to communicate with parents, on what it means when what's the impact on the community when parents make decisions to not get their children vaccinated. You know, these issues about what it is people are concerned about are going to continue to evolve. I think there's just, we're never going to turn the clock back to have parents who are going to just do whatever is suggested to them by an immunization provider without asking any questions. Those are not the people who are going to be coming through the office door from here on out. So we can just get over that. That's not going to happen. So we're going to have to learn how to address parents' concerns better, and I think we're doing that. And there were some great presentations at this conference on that. Just two fast facts, if you didn't hear those presentations, that I'd like to point out. Our CDC team has been working very hard with a number of you on a suite of materials to help foster those vaccine conversations that are being posted online as they become available. And so you can keep track of all of these and look for these new materials as they get rolled out at www.cdc.gov/vaccines/conversations. They'll be there. There's some there now, and there'll be more to come. The other thing on the slide is from Eri Brown's presentation, where she talked about communicating with parents about vaccines. And this was her advice about how to talk to the concerned parent, to tell them, I want what's best for my child and for my patients. That's why I recommend vaccinations. Because that's what, for the most part, parents really want to know. They want it to be acknowledged that they're trying to make a decision in the best interest of their child, and they want you to give them advice based on your expert understanding of what's in their child's best interest. So this was her advice, and I think it's great advice about how to communicate with parents. So now that the cellar door is open and we've come up the steps and we're sort of looking at the lay of the land, we've got new relationships with new providers. And I hope this really will give us a chance to finally do something about adult immunization. As healthcare reform becomes clear and is implemented, this may be finally the time where we can do better. We need to continue to focus on healthcare worker vaccination. If we probably can't do too much better with adult immunization as long as we have healthcare workers that aren't vaccinated themselves. So that probably is the first step. School-located vaccination is a great opportunity. There are some challenges there, but I think together we can work to resolve some of those. And we saw the importance of effective immunization information systems during the last year. I heard from one of you during the conference that in a state where immunization information system development has really lagged, that it was so clear it was needed. And so hopefully there now will be the impetus going forward. For the states that already had strong systems, I hope you emerged even stronger as the value of that system became clear during the pandemic response. And as many of our speakers emphasized, who were talking about the H1N1 response, we clearly are in an era where there is the expectation that we will have more timely information, more locally valuable information faster. These days of waiting a couple of years for results to become available, I think we're going to have to do better than that. You all need information to drive your decision-making and programs at the local level, and certainly there is a sense that we're going to have to do better with getting information in at the appropriate unit of analysis and in a timely way. And we all saw during the pandemic the importance of communication, both among ourselves, between the sectors, between public health and the public, between public health and the private provider community, between us and education. We couldn't have done all this without all of those communication channels being active and working very effectively, and it was really just so important. And I don't think we'll ever go back to the way things were before. So when push came to shove, immunization delivered. The pandemic challenged all of us to do more than we'd ever done before, and you all did it. I mean, it's just so amazing. The planning that had been done only took us just so far because we really did plan for something else other than what happened. So after that, it was creativity, it was improvisation, and I know it was a lot of hard work. But thank you so much for a job well done.